There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman, and I'm your host. Drew Tirico, producer, is at the controls. And on today's program, independent and community radio in Ireland. Our guest today is Andrew Boyle, who has set up one of the very first non-commercial community radio stations in that country. And of course, we'll catch up with what's going on in our media environment with Media Geek Headline News. Do stay tuned. Each week here at Media Geek, we bring you some news of our media environment that typically gets buried in the back of the business pages in our print press and often doesn't get covered at all in your mainstream electronic news. But we think it's important not just to investors and stockholders, but to everyday average people who are interested in real democracy. On December 14th, a coalition of media and activist organizations, including MoveOn.org and Media Matters for America, launched a protest campaign against Sinclair Broadcasting. They're pressuring Sinclair's advertisers with letters complaining of the TV station owner's partisan leanings. Evident in programs like Vice President Mark Hyman's nightly conservative commentary, The Point. In response to this campaign, Hyman told Broadcasting and Cable magazine, quote, "As soon as MoveOn.org allows me to use their email lists and post to their website, maybe then we will have a conversation," end quote. Sinclair is the largest owner of TV stations in the nation and created a stir back in October when it announced plans to air a documentary critical of former presidential candidate John Kerry. But perhaps Hyman believes he's proposing an equal exchange. However, the truth is different. In fact, while MoveOn.org can claim legitimate ownership of its website and email list, Sinclair does not actually own the airwaves it uses to broadcast its TV stations. Sinclair's license to broadcast is granted provisionally and for free by the FCC. Even though it is practically toothless and devoid of enforcement, the Telecommunications Act still requires that broadcasters serve, quote, "the public interest, convenience, and necessity," end quote, in exchange for using the public airwaves. That means that as a television broadcast license holder, Sinclair has obligations beyond its own narrow self-interest.
The FCC declined to open a proceeding to explore the question of whether or not indecency regulation should apply to satellite radio. This rulemaking was requested by Mount Wilson FM Broadcasters Incorporated, a California-based owner of traditional broadcast radio stations. In his one-page decision, Media Bureau Chief Kenneth Faree told Mount Wilson that the agency had previously ruled that, quote, "subscription-based services do not call into play the issue of indecency," end quote. Further, Faree explained, quote, "consistent with existing case law, the FCC does not impose regulations regarding indecency on services lacking the indiscriminate access to children that characterizes broadcasting," end quote. Mount Wilson asked the FCC for rulemaking in response to Howard Stern's decision to join Sirius Satellite Radio. Stern decided to leave terrestrial radio for satellite in part due to the sheer number of indecency fines his syndicated morning radio show has received. This decision is seen as a reassuring sign for subscription television, too, since some lawmakers have recently made noises about having indecency rules apply to cable and satellite TV.
And speaking of indecency, some liberal-leaning bloggers have started a campaign targeting Rush Limbaugh for his use of a four-letter word starting with D, to mean penis, on his December 13th program. The bloggers, led by Oliver Willis at oliverwillis.com, are encouraging listeners to send indecency complaints to the FCC for Rush's use of the word in his program that airs during the afternoon in most markets, the time during which the FCC bans indecent language. The FCC is required to evaluate all indecency complaints, regardless of how many complaints are filed for a particular program. In fact, the precedent-setting FCC v. Pacifica case, which clarified and solidified the FCC's ability to regulate indecent programming, was triggered by just one letter to the FCC. Being able to provide more information about the program in question, such as a transcript, increases the likelihood that the commission will seriously investigate the complaint. The bloggers targeting Limbaugh have published a transcript of Rush's potentially dirty word, making it more certain that the FCC will have to give their complaints due consideration. Unfortunately, Limbaugh was not available for comment. And that's a little bit of what's going on in our media environment. You're listening to Media Geek. Check us out online at www.mediageek.org. You have the Media Geek blog, and you can also download and listen to archive editions of the program in the MP3 and open source Ogg Vorbis formats. Send along complaints and comments to paul@mediageek.org. So Andrew O'Boyle is from Ireland, and you're currently a PhD student at the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois, and you had experience back in Galway setting up one of the first non-commercial community radio stations in that country.
Yes.
And what was the, was it affiliated with the university there?
Yes, it was a student-run radio station licensed to a company owned by the university and a neighbouring educational institution, but on a day-to-day basis operated by the students and a single staff member appointed by that company.
And when did you put the station on the air?
We went on air in 1995. I'd started in college in 1993. Up to that stage, to kind of give a very brief overview of Ireland's broadcasting history, in 1928, a state broadcaster started on air. Until 1990, there had been no licensed stations other than the state broadcaster in the country. On a number of occasions, they had run localized operations, bringing members of communities into areas, but for very short periods of time, a month, 2 months at a time. There had been a growing number of unlicensed operators, primarily commercial pirates or mass culture pirates playing pop music and the like, and a smaller number of community radio stations, some of which actually have gained quite a bit of international attention. One of the stations in Galway was run by a woman called Margaretta Darcy. She ran the famous Radio Pirate Woman, a women's collective, unscripted, unformatted, all-comers radio station. So until 1990, we had no private or non-state radio. Then a licensing regime was put into place, but all of the people who got, or all the stations which went on air, were either commercial or they were dominated by commercial interests. They may have incorporated some previous community stations, but were commercial entities in their new incarnation. In 1994, the IRTC, the Independent Radio and Television Commission, tendered for a small number of community radio stations to act as part of a pilot scheme to investigate whether they should go ahead with licensing community radio into the long term. And we got one of those licenses in November 94 and went on air in September 1995.
So that broadcasting history in Ireland is very different from the United States. And I think a lot of Americans or North Americans don't realize how different it is in the fact that while government-run media, especially on the radio in the United States, has been very uncommon, and in fact in most public radio stations even are not actually run by any state entities. It was otherwise the norm in Ireland and in most of the UK for most of the 20th century, and only recently has any sort of independent radio come on board. And you mentioned that, so when in the opening up of the airwaves in 1990, many more commercial stations came to the fore. And so on the radio dial, is it roughly that do now commercial stations dominate? Do government-run stations dominate? Is it kind of a mix?
Numbers can be diced any number of ways. But let's give an overview. We have, I think, five stations run by the state broadcaster. Our state broadcasters, RTE, Radio Telefiche Éireann, they run a flagship news, news current affairs station, which also has jazz, folk music, traditional Irish music in the evenings. They run, that's RTE Radio 1, Imaginative. They run a classical music and with some jazz station, which is called Lyric FM. There's a pop music station. There's there was, and I think there still is, a local station for Cork City, which is our second largest city. And then there's a fifth station, which is Radio na Gaeltachta, which is an Irish language station aimed at the Irish, at the communities on the west coast of Ireland, which are in which there are many native Irish speakers. So they, that's five stations. Most of those have national coverage at the moment. There's around 40 or so commercial stations. They each, Ireland's overall population is about 4 million. So that's the reach of the national stations. We also have one commercial national station, and then a whole pile of commercial local stations. They have a reach maybe of about 150,000 to a million people apiece. The ones in Dublin, where we've got a population of about a million, obviously reach most of that. And but they're kind of aimed at something about the size of Champaign County, perhaps. Then if you look, then we've also got between 15 and 20 community and community of interest stations. The station I was involved with was a college station or a student station, so it was termed a community of interest station, while we had to operate under community radio and a community radio ethos. We were differentiated from the geographic community stations. Each of those has a population ranging from as small as 10 or 15,000 station for Connemara Community Radio out on the west coast, up to maybe 50,000 to 100,000 for some of the stations in suburban areas of Dublin City.
So you mentioned that your Galway station sort of adheres to the community radio ethos. Mm-hmm. Now, how is that understood in Ireland? Is it different, similar, or does it differ somewhat from how we sort of understand and pursue it here in the United States?
It's actually codified. When the licensing authority was looking to bring in community radio, they had previously licensed one or two, shall we say, anomalies in the Dublin area, which were non-commercial stations. But when they went ahead with the pilot scheme, community radio activists asked that all stations have to include in their contract with... We've two things. Separate from, you know, your transmission license, as you would have here under the FCC, we've a separate license with the broadcast authority, and in that you've got various different commitments regarding your employment procedures and so on. And for community radio stations, they said we had to incorporate as an appendix the AMARC Community Radio Charter for Europe. AMARC is the world body of community radio broadcasters. In 1990, they had a meeting in Slovenia, I think, at which they agreed a charter, which was a kind of a bit of a compromise between the many of the Western European community radio operators who are coming from what I think people here in WEFT, or people who are aware of, you know, how WEFT operates, would be more familiar with. Some of the operators coming from Eastern Europe, talking to people who were involved in the negotiations, they were coming more from a "we are not state radio," and not necessarily differentiating themselves from state radio, as opposed to in Western Europe, where it was just differentiating themselves from commercial radio and also state radio. But so there was a bit of a compromise there. But you get things like volunteers need to be involved in the management structures of the station. You need to be inclusive. You need to be aware of the needs of women, of ethnic minorities, of those who are more vulnerable in society, things of that nature. It's much of it is quite general, but there are you can sense the idea of equity, of access, and of a democratic structure within the operations being reached at.
I think that's interesting because that's actually codified in your the contract for your license then with the licensing
with
body.
The state, yes, with the state licensing body.
Whereas with the Federal Communications Commission here in the United States, even for a non-commercial station like WEFT, there are some basic requirements that we do public service programming, and there are some basic requirements that we be somewhat transparent in our operations. But otherwise, we're not really required to hold such ideals of equity, even though most community stations like a WEFT do actually amongst themselves try to uphold such ideas of equity. And indeed, that's part of the problems I think that many American media activists find is the fact that our stations, commercial and non-commercial, are not held to a sort of higher standard. So what was the motivation at Galway to try and put your station on the air, since it was a pretty new enterprise at that time?
There's several different things coalescing. One is I was always a radio geek. I'd been involved in amateur radio before entering college. I was fascinated by the idea of trying to get a radio station on air. When I went in, I got involved with other people and we set up a radio society among the student body. So that would be kind of an RSO here at UIUC. Then there had been, previous to this, a number of over a number of years, an annual, there's a special type of license you can get called a temporary special event license, where any institution for up to 14 days in a year can get a license to broadcast in association with events. So previously we've got what they call Rag Week or College Week, being a week where students, as opposed to every other week, go wild and have various different charity events associated with the drinking and debauchery, to put it bluntly. And there had been a station which had been operated over a number of years by students for that. However, coming into the college, what I saw was that the people who were running that were people who were professional or semi-professional DJs around town. Trying to get involved with that, you were told, so, you're a professional DJ? Well, you know, no. You can go get sponsorship for us. You can...
So you couldn't actually be on air.
Yeah, exactly. And so we wanted to set up a station in the long term, but also that sort of experience that we had in the interim kind of forced upon us our philosophy, if we didn't already have it, of equal access, of openness, that the main criterion being, do you want to be involved? Do you want to go on air? You go on air. We give you whatever necessary training you need in order to be able to operate the volume controls on a mixing desk. Most people already operate, you know, volume controls at home, and then to help you with whatever, you know, if we have interviewing training and so on, so that people can build up their skills if they want. But the basic thing of access and ability to get involved, inclusivity, and that being kind of our guiding goal.
And this is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical look at our media environment. We're speaking to Andrew O'Boyle. He is a former community radio activist in Ireland, and he is now here in Urbana-Champaign studying at the University of Illinois Institute of Communications Research. And he's talking to us about the radio scene in Ireland and, of course, much more specifically about the community radio station and college station that he helped put on the air in Galway in Ireland. And so, Andrew, before you put the station on the air, were you and some of the other people who helped volunteer in that effort aware of the community radio movements more globally and aware of what other stations did?
Initially, to quite a limited extent, we were coming at this mainly as a group of 17, 18, 19-year-olds who knew this must be happening elsewhere. There's kind of, you know, shall we say, a romantic folk knowledge of, you know, US college radio back in the day. And, you know, so, there, you know, there is a sense that this is something that happens. Luckily, as I said, there was a community radio movement in Ireland which had, while not being as strong or as big as the commercial pirate movement did exist, and some of those people were involved with other efforts to start stations on air, and indeed there was one or two people who had moved to teaching in the university we were based in. So while they weren't directly involved in our effort, they did give us talks and training and so on, and help give us some insight into AMERC in particular, if not the, you know, AMERC and the AMERC Europe experience, if not the broader global efforts.
And so when you decided to put the station on the air, did you get very strong support from the university? And also, I guess, what you would need really is funding from the university.
Eventually we did. Due to indecency and obscenity regulations, I'm not allowed to say some of the things that they said to us. The university, to a certain extent, by mistake, committed to giving us funding and support. We did get a certain amount of funding. We set up the station with, at the time, I think they gave us £20,000 over 18 months was their commitment, over two years essentially, including setup stage. £10,000 would now be about, given the declining dollar, about 30,000 or so. At that stage, you know, buying power was more about, you know, $20,000-$25,000. But so we did have money to, you know, to buy equipment. They did give us some space in a warehouse where we did get a studio and so on. And we did have, what we were very lucky with was the institutional support was mixed. There were individuals within the university who were able to, you know, stick their head on the line or assist us with, you know, chairing committees, taking part in that process. So I think it would be fair to say we got what was needed. Certain individuals within the college were more better for us than the institution as a whole.
And so, about how many volunteers then were involved in putting the station on the air?
I managed the station for the first year, from September 95 to 96. My calculation was that we had 250 different people on air in a production or presenting role of some nature. Not all of those were regular week-by-week people. We had maybe 100 to 150 people who were involved week by week, dropping out, you know, over the course of the year as exams came up or as they got involved in other societies and dropped this one. About another 50 people being students on varying journalism and media courses, both in the university and in the two, we were run by two educational institutions jointly, primarily the university at which I was, but also to a certain extent we had students from the other. So we had about 50 people who were journalism and media students, and then maybe another 50 people who were members of the public, who were involved occasionally or who were involved with a certain number of community organizations that we got involved. We did outreach to them and had them run airtime and have their own programs. So that would be the breakdown there.
And that was going to be my next question, is to what extent non-students, people from the community and maybe community organizations, are allowed to get on the air at the station, and about how much of the programming do they make up?
It varies year by year, because obviously much of the decision around that depends on the station manager and the programming decisions made within the station on a year-by-year basis. Because you're dealing with a student station, things are much more transitory than they would be with a station like WEFT, and program policy is, as a result, more fluid and more changing, or changes more regularly. At the time at which I would be familiar, we would have... Primarily, the station is aimed at the student body. It's meant to be, the phrase we used, radio by students for students. But we did have, because of our programming, or because of our licensing requirements as well, we don't go 24 hours or anything like that. We had a 40% talk quota, so we stuck to having about between 8 and 10 hours a day. So we were doing something about 40 hours a week. Maybe one or two hours of that were run by community organizations. We also did outreach to high school students, and so we had between 1 and 3 hours a week done by them on a regular basis. And there were also a number of members of the public who were, you know, friends of friends who got involved, or, you know, we weren't so strict on, you know, the extent to which you had to be currently a registered student, but primarily students, and a little bit of outreach to other organizations.
And the station's still on the air, correct?
Station's still on the air, celebrating 10 years on air next September.
That's really good to hear. I guess in the last minute or two we have left, my question to you is, so what's maybe the most important or the most sort of significant thing you took away from the experience of putting the station on the air and being able to bring a college and community radio station to Galway?
Ooh, ten words or less. Hard work, sleepless nights. There's two things you need. You need an overarching vision. You need to know what it is, whether or not, you know, if you want something that's inclusive and just allowing everyone to get on air and have their slice of pie, good. If you want something where you're serving, you know, the cultural community and bringing arts-based programming, documentaries, but just have an idea, have a coherent idea of what that is. And then after that, you've got to make sure that you're very careful with the very different, dividing up the various different tasks in terms of finance, programming, operations, putting proper structures in place. Structure.
Because then that gives you the freedom, huh?
And working microphones, I would say.
Working microphones are also a very wonderful thing to have. Or working cables, whatever it happens to be.
Morse keys will do.
Is the station on the internet at all, or do they have a website?
They have a website. The website is flirtfm.org, flirtfm.org. They don't do a webcast. They had for a period of time a kind grad student was facilitating that for them. There has been tightening up in terms of copyright licensing and so on in Ireland. I understand it may be something that may happen in the future, but at the moment, just financially, it's not a priority for them.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Andrew, for coming here and informing us a bit about Irish Community and College Radio. It's Andrew O'Boyle. He is a PhD student at the Institute of Communications Research and a former community radio activist back there in Galway in Ireland. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.